Man, there's so much stuff to do. I wish I wasn't such a lazy asshole and someone could come hold my hand and do it all for me.
Have no fear! The social contractor is here!
Oh boy, the social contractor! What's your power?
I build and buy things without your consent, regardless of whether or not you want them. And then I expect you to pay for it when I'm done!
Well, that sounds like a horrible superpower.
I noticed your car was broken, so I hired a repairman!
Oh, well, thank you.
I also noticed your roof was leaking, so I hired a roofer!
Well, that was pretty thoughtful, thanks.
And finally, I noticed that you didn't have any cats, so I ordered you 6,000 tons of cat food.
Why the f*** would I need 6,000 tons of cat food?
Well, Jason, I really didn't know that you hated cats so much. I just really love and want to feed all of them. Also, my best friend owns the cat food factory. Now pay up!
What? Are you insane? I'm not paying for all this!
Oh, you had no problem with me when I was fixing your car and repairing your roof. But the second I dump 6,000 tons of cat food on your property and expect you to pay for it, now I'm being unreasonable.
Dude, get the hell out of here! I'm done with you!
You know, Jason, if you really don't like it, you can move to Somalia.
That crazy libertarian, Jason. He always did have problems with authority.
Yes, indeed.
Why don't we have problems with authority?
Because we're adults, and paying for 6,000 tons of cat food is part of the deal.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Peace of Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network every Thursday at 1 p.m. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have a really awesome guy, Seamus Coughlin. He's a libertarian, and he's 20 years old. He's actually studying animation production in college right now. He's going to enter his junior year, and he's the founder of freedomtoons.com, and his YouTube channel is Cartanimation. He's on Patreon, patreon.com/freedomtoons. So, if you can throw him some, Federal Reserve notes, he would be most grateful because we all need some help every once in a while, you know, especially when we're doing this freedom stuff. It's not free.
Right? That's the truth. It costs a lot of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, time is money. So that's the thing. So he's also on Twitter. You can follow him at Seamus_Coughlin. So, Seamus, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm actually really glad to get a chance to sit down and talk with you.
Yeah, yeah. We've been trying to get this together for the past few months.
A little while. Yeah.
Finally got it done, so I'm really happy. So before we get into your animation, why don't you give us a little bit of background about how you got into libertarianism, you know, what influenced you, and also how you got into animation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like most hardcore libertarians, Ron Paul was my gateway drug. And then from Ron Paul, it kind of transitioned into searching up some libertarian philosophy, trying to research that. Came across Stefan Molyneux, who I got a lot of the philosophical arguments from. And in terms of the roller coaster that led me down this path external to all that, I was raised in as you may have guessed from my hopelessly ethnic name, I was raised in a very Irish Catholic home. And so that meant my parents were always conservative but not Republican, in the sense that there were a number of things that we saw were screwy with the Republican Party, but of course we still had these very conservative Christian values. And I think as I got older and more involved with politics, because from a young age this stuff always interested me. I was the kid in class arguing with my teacher about why, and of course, when you go to public school in Cook County, you deal with some big government liberals. And don't get me wrong, I had a lot of great teachers, but I certainly had a number of political disagreements with them in class. And it kind of got to a point where even though I would label myself as a conservative, I was almost a libertarian, but I just didn't know it yet. I always had this belief that, look, yes, I do have these very old school Christian traditions and values, but I think that we shouldn't have a government which forces people to take part in any particular path. And at the very least, if one should exist, it should simply be there to respect life, liberty, property rights. So I started to head down this road where I was more of a constitutionalist. And then Stefan Molyneux was more of my gateway drug into a much more hardcore kind of anarchism. But as in terms of my family life and my background, I was the youngest of four. Great family. I'm very blessed, actually, with a wonderful, wonderful group that I call my family. I mean, my mom and dad are both very intelligent, well-educated people. They're also very generous and helpful people. They've helped me through a lot. They've always been very accepting of my choices in life. And then I have two older brothers and an older sister. And my older brother, my oldest brother, is actually libertarian as well. So he and I agree on that. He's more of on the conspiracy theorist end of libertarianism. So we don't see eye to eye fully. And then as for my parents, I kind of bring everyone in my family a little bit closer to the dark side every day. And just recently, when my dad was on a political rant, he called his adversary a statist instead of a liberal. So I was very, very proud of that.
You're making small inroads into their mental...
Exactly. Except I don't believe in roads. Right. So they're not even inroads there. You think I'm some kind of statist? Without the government, who's going to pave the inroads?
Exactly.
Into our-
the mental inroads.
Yeah.
So Stefan Molyneux was a major influence. Any books that you read, or are you mostly a student of like podcasts and audiobooks?
I'm an animator. I don't read books. No, actually, there were a number of books that influenced me, actually, but I think most importantly, it was Molyneux, because even though, again, I've made fun of him in the past a little, he says some crazy things now and then, but he had a really good way of breaking these arguments down into their most pure and simple form. And so it was really the non-aggression principle that clicked with me. And after that point in time, there was no turning back. And so that was really the main inspiration, I think.
Yeah, for me too. Like, Stefan Molyneux really, I was introduced to him when my son, five years ago, was just before a year old, and my wife sent me The Truth About Spanking by Stefan Molyneux, and that really opened my eyes to peaceful parenting and the effects of spanking on kids, and then, you know, from there was everything else, voluntarism and anarcho-capitalism and all that cool stuff, and philosophy. I love philosophy, so yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome guy.
I should also mention before I move on from my background, and I'm sure we'll come back to it at some point, but my dad was a philosophy teacher. Ooh. And he would always challenge me as a kid and ask me these different questions. So that's another reason I was attracted to Stefan's channel. I also believe that, with you mentioned spanking and such, I'm definitely an advocate of peaceful parenting. I'm not as hardcore about it as a lot of Molinites can sometimes be, but that's one of those things that you can't necessarily turn a blind eye to.
Yeah.
When you look at, for example, circumcision is a big one. Another big one is the degree to which spanking can lower IQ. Yeah. Right out of Stefan Molyneux's handbook there, but it is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's so important to, to challenge these habits of custom that we've been doing just because other people have been doing it, right? That's and which is exactly why we challenge public school. You know, a lot of these things that people have always done, you know, and when we come out and say, no, actually, that's wrong. And they're like, what are you talking about? Everyone's doing it. It's always been done this way. So,
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because I remember when I was in about fifth grade, we had the DARE program at my school, which is essentially an anti-drug group.
Yeah.
And one thing they said about drugs and alcohol and why we should abstain from them was, just because everyone's doing something doesn't mean it's okay to do, and it doesn't mean you should do it. And I remember sitting there and saying, wait a minute, I thought we lived in a democracy. Like, I thought the very foundation upon which our nation is founded is this idea that the majority is supposed to be correct all the time.
Right.
That was another moment that kind of caused me to question things. Because all throughout your childhood, you have people telling you, just because the majority does it doesn't mean it's okay. Then they turn around, push you into a voting booth and say, all right, you're going to decide what the majority believes and therefore what is morally adequate.
Right, exactly. And I saw a great meme about, like, you know, you see the top, two people making love, and like, if you wouldn't force, you know, somebody to make love with you, why would you force your opinion on somebody through voting? Right? So they're both a violation of consent, right? That's what it boils down to. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. There's certain things that I will admit I do vote on, but that's just because, at least in my county, I don't know how it is everywhere, but they allow you to vote on individual issues.
Oh,
so I'll just go on there. no, just vote no on everything walk out. But you're right. It is completely insane that we have certain standards of consent for different interactions, and that's a reason for which I think it's pretty easy to debunk the social contract, because if consent truly is based on geography, then the argument people make when a woman gets raped, what was she doing in that neighborhood, is supposedly entirely valid if we're allowed to say you agree to be a part of something simply by being there.
Yeah. That reminds me of was that your first or your second video on the social contractor?
I believe that was the first libertarian video I did, and I can actually get into that in a moment. But that was the first one, I believe. Yes.
Yeah, was that your most your highly viewed video? Your most viewed video?
So my most viewed video was the Stefan Molyneux video.
Oh, really? That's an awesome one also.
yeah. But I think. As of now, how government works is probably my most viewed. It's got 10,000 something.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, go into that a little bit. Explain that one, how government works.
So how government works is basically what ended up leading to freedomtunes.com and why I ended up developing it. And the reason was I was working with some right-wing conservative groups. And again, like I mentioned to you, but maybe not to the audience yet, I've been freelancing in animation since I was 14. I began teaching myself when I was 12, and I fell in love with the art form. And so I would always try to find a gig or some way to bring in a little bit of extra money. And it wasn't even so much that the money was great, because I was young and didn't need it, but there was just a certain validation of my talent by the fact that people were willing to pay something to see my work.
Yeah.
So it was something I always did. And then at the beginning of my college experience, I was asked to make a number of videos for a friend who had a website, and it was actually a right-wing political website, but she was a closet libertarian. That's why we got along so well. But I developed these videos on contract. I made some decent money doing it, and their website actually ended up being acquired or partnered with a new website that was being developed by a gentleman who was a Fox News contributor and comedian named Kevin Jackson. He's got a website called The Black Sphere, and it's relatively popular amongst conservatives, especially black conservatives. And so there were a number of videos that I was working on for them, but once there were bigger players involved who maybe had a little more pull within the industry, there was kind of more pressure to censor my work and maybe make political statements that I wasn't comfortable making.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually had a number of superheroes. We were going to develop this little animated series about a superhero, and that's really all I'm allowed to say, because I am basically legally obligated not to give out too much information about this project as a result of the fact that it was canceled.
Oh.
But there were superheroes, and everyone was pitching their ideas. There was actually this one professional comedian working with us, and again, the gentleman from Fox was working with us. But I kind of felt like they wanted to push me in this corner where I was going to be the animator and they were going to come up with the ideas, because every time I threw an idea at them for like a funny superhero that related to politics, they would reject it.
Mm.
And so I thought of this hero called Social Contractor, and his superpower is he builds and buys things without your consent and then expects you to pay for it when you're done. But every single time I pitched something, they would say it was, and this isn't me blowing smoke on my own ass, they basically say, all right, this is too brainy, like the majority of audiences won't get this, we want to keep it simple.
Yeah.
I thought, why not make something funny, but that's also, you know, funny and comprehensive, but actually have some substance to it. And so I ended up making The Social Contractor, and I just threw that video together in my spare time and put it up on the channel, and it was more successful than I had anticipated, especially considering I didn't do anything to promote it.
Oh, that's amazing. I know.
And yeah, so I was actually pretty excited, and that's when I began to speak with Randall, and he ended up building a website for me, and moving forward, that's how Freedom Tunes began.
That's Randall Parker, right?
Yeah, Randall Parker. He's a great guy. If anyone in the community is looking to get themselves started, or you want to build a website or something, he's definitely the guy to talk to. He'll probably charge you a little bit, but his fees are not unreasonable in any sense of the word. And again, he's very easy to work with. He's a great guy.
Cool. Yeah, my wife started it November 2013, but she hasn't really improved on it much since then. So it's just basically like stayed the same. But yeah, it's awesome when other people help you. It's like, you know, it's funny, like you said, you know, you didn't really do it, you know, to make money, I guess, or to try to promote it. It just blew up naturally.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing how that happens?
And it totally is.
And then when you're doing this stuff, like I'm making videos and writing my articles, and then people come to you and they say, you know what, I like your work, I want to help you out and improve your website or help you make a logo maybe if you don't have a logo. And I just found that that's pretty awesome that, you know, you're just putting content out there constantly and people want to help you, you know, because they love what you're doing so much. Right.
And it's also just such a wonderful community of people, too, the libertarian community. I joke a lot. I'm a bit of a self-loathing libertarian, as it were, because there are a number of people in the movement who we joke about, the fedora, basement dwellers, et cetera, et cetera. But most of the people in the movement are actually really, really friendly and cool. And I think that is borne out by the fact that when I released this video making fun of Stefan Mowney, which, again, I've admitted was maybe a bit harsh, a number of people, including his fans, gave the video likes and just commented about how much they liked the video. So this is a group of people that has generally a sense of humor about themselves, and they're here to help. I mean, they're not as in-your-face and angry as they're constantly portrayed as being.
Yeah. Did Stefan Mowney contact you at all about that?
No. He blocked me on Facebook, actually.
He blocked you on Facebook?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I tried to add him. One of his friends tweeted the video at him after – one of his friends posted the video to him after it was made. I tried to add Stefan. I was like, oh, maybe he'll think it's funny, but he actually blocked me on Facebook. I don't blame him. Dude, I don't blame him at all. Like, if that man hates me, I fully understand. I still like his work, but I get it. I ripped him up. I mean, it was just a goofy little video, but...
All right. So I think before we started recording, we were talking about stand-up comedy. Like, I used to do stand-up comedy. You used to do it, right? A little comedy. So can you go into that and, you know, and maybe what you talk about, you know, in your comedy?
Yeah, sure. So I can actually maybe send you some audio clips, but I had this whole bit about gun control, and there's a group called Moms Against Guns or Moms Demand Common Sense, something to that effect.
Right.
And my whole bit was, look, we can't start banning shit because moms don't like it. Like, that's an awful idea. That's going to bring us down a path where you're going to – and I would go off on this whole rant, and then the main gag of it was, if Mothers Against Guns can get rid of the Second Amendment, can Mothers Against Access get rid of the First Amendment? And so,
wait, can Mothers Against Guns? You broke out a little bit.
If Mothers Against Guns can get rid of the Second Amendment, can Mothers Against Backsass get rid of the First Amendment?
Backsass? What was that?
You know, backsass is like talking back, like when your kids talk back to you.
Oh, I didn't even know that. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Term. Okay, never mind that term.
So that's just like one example that I can think of off the top of my head. Yeah. Thank you. I would do a lot of writing, and the audience would actually really, really like it, and they'd eat it up. And I remember doing a bit where I actually – Rand Paul sent me an email. You know, they have those auto-send emails where they, it's from Rand Paul, but obviously it's not really from Rand Paul.
Right.
And I got the email, and I sent him a really excited reply, playing stupid, pretending I actually think it's him. And I remember I read that one aloud for a bit, and people ate it up, and they thought it was really funny. So I would just do a number of little politically charged things, or at least I would sprinkle political jokes throughout the act or the bit to get people thinking, but most of it just centered around stupid stuff that didn't have to do with anything.
So you perform in like local comedy clubs near you?
Yeah, every now and then. I haven't done it in a little while because I've been so busy, but I'm probably going to start again sometime soon. And especially when I go away to school, I'm going to be down in Georgia, meeting new people, making new contacts. So I'll probably check out some comedy clubs they have there and try out a little bit of material, because it's something I love doing. And I haven't bombed yet. I'm going to at some point. You have to. I'm probably doing something wrong, actually, because I haven't bombed yet. But
yeah.
I'm going to keep doing it, and then I'm going to bomb, and I'm just going to go home and cry, and then I'm probably never going to do it again.
Nah.
And I'm just going to – I'm like, no, I hate those guys. I'm just going to make cartoons. They don't know anything.
Yeah, I did comedy in 2011. I started with my brother. We took a 7-week comedy class, and then afterwards, you know, we went out and started doing the clubs, and it's awesome. Yeah, it's so much fun. You know, you learn so much about yourself doing comedy, you know. I tell people, when I tell people about it, you know, the most common reply is, I can never do that. I have stage fright. You know, I have terrible public speaking fear. And I say everybody does, you know, who is like, wakes up and like, you know what? I want to do stand up comedy. Like, who doesn't have a problem speaking in front of large crowds? You know, everybody does.
No, you're absolutely right. It's one of those things that is probably the most difficult thing to get yourself up on stage to do, but it's really rewarding once you do it. That and singing, I would say. Because comedy and singing are the two things you'll do in public which have the greatest probability of people hating you.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, if you give... I've done a lot of public speaking, and I love it, but it's a lot easier because the chances of people booing you off stage during a public speech are so slim.
Mm-hmm.
It very rarely happens, but it happens to singers and comedians all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what people are really the most afraid of.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, you're basically naked. It's just you and a microphone. Mm-hmm. That's it. You can't hide behind any props, any, you know, instrument or anything. Most of the time it's just you and the microphone. And yeah, it's an awesomely revealing experience about your own personality. And so, yeah, I highly recommend it to anyone, you know.
Yeah. Honestly, anyone try it. Anyone try it. You'll probably do better than you think you will. And it's really I'm not like some seasoned comic or something. I've, you know, done a few open mics, told a few jokes, made a few people laugh. So the only advice I really have to offer, the only thing I've picked up on is just have a good opening joke, really. If you have a good opening joke, you can talk about anything and people will laugh. But if your opening joke is bad, like... You gotta follow it up with something really, really good. Because that actually happened to me once, where my opening joke did not land, and then I was like, "All right, I need to be funny really quickly, or I'm gonna bomb."
Right.
So
who's your comic influences?
Oh man, I don't even know where to begin with that. Honestly, I mean,
yeah, your favorite.
This is gonna sound really cheesy, but anyone who's funny. I mean, I just kind of again, I grew up in a family. That was Irish, and so, you know, there's the stereotype about the Irish sense of humor, but some of my uncles were so funny, and my brother was always really funny, too. I mean, it's just everyone in my family was usually pretty funny, and they'd make a quip about something every now and then, and my cousins were usually hysterical as well, and I just remember thinking, like, I want to make people laugh like they can make people laugh, and that's part of why I became an animator, too, because the difference is... You have to deliver everything a particular way every single time you're on stage to get a certain reaction. Mm. I mean, I animate a video once and throw it up there, and people will see the exact same thing every single time they watch it. And so it's a double-edged sword there because you don't necessarily get the satisfaction maybe from, you know, seeing your audience directly.
Yeah.
But yeah, the reason for which I did comedy and the reason for which I began doing animation are basically the exact same, because there were a lot of people who were funny. I admired the fact that they were able to make other human beings laugh, and I really wanted to do that myself. And I also wanted to educate too.
Yeah.
So if I could sneak some messages into my work... obviously, I'm not so subtle about that with Freedom Tunes, but in my other work, there's always something, you know, maybe even hidden to brainwash the audience into seeing things my way.
And you know what's so important, I think, is that when people start going down the path of learning, you know, what is government, what is law, what is a tax, right? It gets kind of depressing in the beginning because, you know, you look at, you know, guns, it's an opinion with a gun, you know, taxation is theft and regulation strangulates the entrepreneur and all this kind of stuff. So it's a lot of, you know, dark and depressing topics. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's so important that we infuse some comedy and some lightheartedness into this message, because it's so easy for people to just lose positivity, lose hope, and then if you're all dark and gloomy, what's the point of wanting you know,
freedom at all
if you're just all depressed? And also, if we really want people to you know, take a look at voluntarism or anarchy or libertarianism or the non-aggression principle, you know, we're not going to do that by being depressing or being...
No, you're absolutely right.
Or, you know, fearing, you know, being that telling them to be afraid of the wealth transfer or the economic collapse, you know. You have to make them laugh, right? I forget who said it. I think it's Oscar Wilde. He said, if you want to tell someone the truth, first you make them laugh or else they're going to kill you.
Yeah. Right? I love that one. If you have to tell people the truth, make them laugh or they'll kill you, or something to that effect.
Right.
That's so true, though. Oh, it's true. It's very true. People love comedy being infused with their depression. They love comedy being infused with like a cold, hard hit with reality, because maybe it softens the blow.
Yeah.
But I would definitely agree with you. Comedy is so important. And just being nice to people and cool to people in general is the most important thing, because, I mean, faiths and ideology are more caught than they are taught.
Yeah.
It's not so much, I mean, don't get me wrong, with libertarianism, honestly, with me, it was more of just a fully logical transformation as opposed to an emotional one.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something to the fact that, look, if someone can't be swayed with facts and reason, then just be cool to them. Just be nice to them. Yeah. A, because you're a decent human being and you should be nice to others in general. Right. But B, because you're more likely to, again, build those inroads into their mind and kind of make them want what you... It's kind of like making people want what you're having. Like, if I'm eating soup at a restaurant and I'm like, God, this sucks. This is so bad. And I'm just like sitting there whining and complaining. Or if I'm like looking, if I'm like eating my soup and like pointing at everyone, like, but your soup sucks. Like, mine is great. They're like, well, how do you know? You know what I mean? You really just have to emphasize on how amazing the soup you're eating is. And you're like, this is great. I'm so happy. This soup made me. You should all order it. Like, that's the way I see it.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, so with my comedy, and I think I noticed this with your videos as well, is that I'm very self-deprecating, right? So,
yes!
And I think that's one of the best ways to, you know, to help people to laugh is because if, you know, there are certain comedians that, you know, that make fun of, you know, we're different religions or you know, gays or blacks or whatever, and they're not those religions, they're not black, they're not gay. And so if you do that, or say you're a skinny person, you make fun of fat people, you're not going to be you're not going to be popular for a long time. You're going to be hated. You're immediately dividing the crowd. But if you make fun of yourself, you know, everything about yourself, your family, your kids, your wife, your family, your religion, whatever, you know, people, they can't, how can they hate you? That's just you, you know? And
well, it's like,
go ahead.
No, I don't mean to cut you off, but it's like, what are you going to say about me that I haven't already said about myself?
Right.
Like, how are you? It's kind of like, in a weird way, making fun of yourself is the comedic way of saying, I'm crazy, don't mess with me. Because it's like, it's like when somebody, it's like there's this, I was told a long time ago that if like you're really afraid that someone's going to hurt you or that a group of people are going to jump you, like start talking to yourself or act crazy or something and they're going to leave you alone. Or like, can you imagine if, you know, you were like there, like you're this like big macho dude and you just like take a blade and like cut your arm open or something, that whoever's willing to fight you is going to be like, no, like, this guy's crazy. He obviously is not afraid of pain. So it's kind of a way of saying that to, like, hecklers or haters. Like, obviously I can take a joke about myself. You're not going to say anything that's going to destroy me. I'm willing to do this to myself of my own volition. So.
Exactly. Yeah, I forget who said that. But, yeah, they said first make fun of yourself because then they have nothing. They can't, yeah, they can't use anything against you. You can't say anything to harm you because you've already just destroyed yourself.
Exactly.
But when I talk to people, like I meet people in the street, like I'm with my kids, we go out to like, you know, parks and playgrounds and libraries and, you know, meet different people that way. I meet a lot of people, that, are not, you know, homeschoolers because, you know, we do the homeschooling and
good for you.
And yeah, it's awesome. I love it. And so, you know, it's my chance to spread voluntarism and libertarianism and non-aggression. And, but the way I do it is, first, you got to make them laugh. Like you got to show them that you're a relaxed person. That you're not. I mean, it's funny you say crazy. Like that like you're not a crazy person. But they.
Yeah.
But they just make them laugh because it's
let their guard down.
It's really yeah because it's really amazing how, you know, laughter breaks the ice of an initial encounter with somebody, and then once they're laughing, then you can tell them so many more things than if they're defensive, you know, and you just like outright attacking their beliefs, and then you're going to put up their barriers, and then you're just not going to get through at all. So it's pointless. So laughter is the first thing for me. Yeah.
Well, it's like it's insane when you think about the fact that with your words, you're able to produce a dopamine flow in somebody else's brain that's going to basically cause them to make monkey sounds. Like, the fact that we have the ability to do that to one another, and the fact that, A, we don't use that more often because it's so advantageous in so many situations, but you're absolutely right. It breaks somebody's guard down. This person just made me happy. They gave me an incredible spike in happiness and well-being for a moment there, so I'm going to be more likely to listen to what they have to say.
Yeah. So... yeah, sometimes my wife is hounding me because I'm the complete jokester all the time. Like, I hate being serious. I really do. It's like I don't know. It's just like why are you going to spend time being serious? You know, I mean, sure, we can talk about these concepts and these principles and the theory, and that's good. But in the end, you know, it's like if you're not laughing about it, then what's the point of it, right? The point of life is in the enjoyment of it, right?
I would agree to a certain extent. Like, if you don't find a way, I had a friend the other day. We were talking about something. Some mutual liberal friend of ours said something completely insane, and I don't even remember what it was. But my buddy Matt said, like, if you don't laugh at this, it's going to make you cry. Like, if you don't laugh at this stuff, this stuff's going to make you cry. And that's so true, because I hear so many crazy things all the time, every day, from different political groups. And it's like all you can do is laugh. If I sit here and get mad or upset about this, which probably wouldn't be an inappropriate response, I'm just going to be more miserable. It's like laughing and getting sad or getting angry can all be an appropriate response to the same situation, but you'll live longer if you laugh, trust me.
Right. Yeah, I think, I forget who said it, but one of my other favorite quotes is, to those who feel, life is a drama, and to those who think, life is a comedy. or something like that. To those who feel life is a tragedy, something like that. But yeah, the idea is that, you know, you just gotta laugh. So yeah, that's why I'm really grateful for you, you know, doing what you're doing. It's really awesome.
Hey, I appreciate that. So, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's cool. So all right, let's go on to your other video. So you talked about the first one and then the Stefan Molyneux. So what are the other ones that you did that you can?
All right, sure. I have a number of other ones up at this point in time. One is a puppet news video. I was actually planning to do more of these, but I would basically get paper, like, bag puppets and do them in front of my green screen over there and make it look like they were delivering the news. And obviously the joke is that they're puppets. Yeah, you get your news from puppets.
Right.
And,
cool.
You know, it was actually easy to write. It was a lot more quick for me to do it than animation. So I'm surprised I haven't done more of them. It just hasn't been on my mind. Mm-hmm. And I guess I like making videos about things that have a much more, how do I put this? I don't like it to have an expiration date. And obviously stuff with current events has a very sudden expiration date.
True.
So I haven't done as many of those. But besides that, I basically have been doing videos as part of a series I call What Libertarians Actually Believe. And it's just kind of a little animated version of myself talking down to the audience. I shouldn't say talking, just educating. And that was actually part of my goal, was to ensure that if I was explaining these concepts to people, again, I wanted it to not only be in a comedic way, but to really be in a kind way that's not really condescending. Mm. And that's why there's some self-deprecation in the video, because, I'm not going to be some 19-year-old white kid from, or now 20, I'm not going to be some 20-year-old white kid from the suburbs telling everyone else in the world how to live their life. Like, that's insane.
Right.
But I do think I have something to offer in terms of educating people on certain concepts, and so that's kind of what I want to keep the video to, a lot of people want to become libertarian content creators, and everyone wants to have their voice heard in one way or another.
Yeah.
But I feel like you have so many really kind of angry, stern Molyneux wannabes. And again, nothing wrong with – well, I shouldn't say there's nothing wrong with Molyneux. I don't agree with everything he says. But Molyneux fills a space very well.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't need anyone's help. So if you're doing the same thing that Stefan Molyneux does – you're not really going to pick up any views. No one's going to be interested, as sad as that sounds. I mean, Stefan Molyneux got to it first, obviously.
But
that's basically it. That, like, I noticed that when I would release vlogs on a different YouTube channel, and I actually did some stuff for the Voluntary Virtues Network, even though I usually wasn't mean or angry, but when I would go off on these rants, it's kind of like, who cares? Who cares? You're a 19-year-old white kid from the suburbs who hasn't even really needed to worry about paying rent or all these other things, ranting at people about why you're so pissed off at the world. Like, it just doesn't fit, and I could see why it would anger or annoy people. I could see why people wouldn't want anything to do with it. So that's why I said, well, people like cartoons, so I can brainwash them that way.
So what was the name of your show on Voluntary Virtue Network?
Christianarchy. I did it with Corey and Danny. I don't know if it's still up. I know that some of the hosts had a falling out. I'm still cool with everybody. Mm-hmm. I try to stay out of people's conflicts.
Okay.
Let
me go back to the Stefan Molyneux video really quick, because I think one of the things that catapulted that video, like, for me into like stratospherical, you know, hilariousness is when you were doing it, you know, the puppet, and then his eye was falling off. Was that intentional? Or?
No. Come on, I'm not that funny. I couldn't.
That was awesome.
I wish I was that funny.
That was genius.
Dude, the eye fell off, and like I'm sitting there doing the puppet stuff. Or, well, let me give you a little bit of background first. Actually, while I was doing Christianarchy on the Voluntary Virtues Network, probably about a year and a half ago, Corey and Danny and I would still kind of chat in the Google Hangout after the show was over, and I would just do little voices and impressions for them, and we would talk about Stefan Molyneux, so I would do a little Stefan Molyneux impression, and Corey would die every time, and he was like, dude, you got to just record yourself doing that and send it to me. So one day, he was in some comment war with somebody else on Facebook, and I was involved in it, and Stefan Molyneux came up, so I just really quickly, like, improv in front of the mic with my webcam on and did a Stefan Molyneux impression and posted it, and everyone on the thread thought it was really funny, and I didn't actually think anything of it for a number of months until finally I decided I wanted to put it up on YouTube, but my webcam was so bad that I didn't want to upload the video, so I was like, well, I'll just make a puppet of Stefan Molyneux. So I'm sitting there playing the audio in the background, working the puppet. And then one of the eyes falls off, and I'm like, oh no, like, should I stop and put the eye back on? But I was like, no, I'm just going to keep going with this. I'm going to keep going. And I'm really happy I did, because that seems to be everyone's favorite part of the video, is that loses his eyes.
It was just, I thought it was genius. I guess, you know, it's funny, the things that spontaneously happen is like that, the things that you don't intend is what really, you know, catapults these videos into, like, you know, fame.
Yeah, no disagreement there. That's why, and it's why I got blocked. Maybe that's where he drew the line. Maybe he saw his eye fall off. He said, my God, my eye, and he's like, he blocked me. Fuck.
Maybe he would have. He would have been fine.
Are we that sick? Huh? Yeah, he was just very upset, dude. Honestly, again, I make fun of him a lot. I totally get it. I would have blocked me too. I totally would have blocked me too. I mean, I was very harsh with him.
I mean, I feel like if somebody made a caricature of me or some kind of, you know, spoof like that, I would be flattered. I would be honored that somebody actually took the time to do that.
No, and I would be too, but you and I seem to have a very different predisposition than Stefan Molyneux to this type of thing. Again, I like Molyneux. I like the stuff he says and does. He's kind of a serious gentleman.
But then he intersperses his serious presentations with some really corny jokes, some really cheesy. It's so funny.
I actually really like that though. Like, I really enjoy his presentations. I laugh.
I do. I mean, yeah, it's so funny. It's like if you're not paying attention, you're not gonna notice, because he doesn't change intonation at all. Like, he keeps going, right?
No.
He doesn't laugh at himself. He just keeps going. But
can you imagine if he did though? Can you imagine what a dick he would be if he did? If he just stopped to laugh at himself,
I know.
The middle of your Stefan video, you'd be like, get out of here, Stefan.
yeah, Stefan Molyneux is amazing. I can't believe he's only got like 250,000 subscribers. I would think that he would get more. You know, he's always like saying, you know, largest philosophy show in the world, and right, and the kind of stuff.
Yeah. But, his website's pretty huge, but you're right. Like, largest philosophy podcast, you're kind of a big fish in a small pond. No offense. It's great that he's a large philosophy podcast. It's great that he's the largest and that he's libertarian and he's spreading the message. But when you think about the fact that most podcasts, I shouldn't trash podcasts in general, but I just think we have a culture that isn't, we just have a culture that's not interested in that kind of thing. But I will say, him and Joe Rogan's interview on the Joe Rogan Experience was like one of the most, I think the most downloaded podcast of all time. It broke a record when it came out.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Stefan is very, very popular, no doubt.
Yeah.
He's one of the few libertarian names recognized by the general machine, so. Mm.
So then you had your recent one that you released today, I think, right? The Planned Parenthood?
This is interesting. What I was planning to do was just spend a little bit of time working on what libertarians actually believe. I've written a script for a number of different issues, and I wanted to take some time off to just work on a bunch of videos so that I can release one a week or one every other week, and then, you know, you have consistent content, you grow your audience numbers, you get more money donated to you. It's just better for the channel to be consistent.
Yeah.
So I decided to take time off and just work on what libertarians actually believe, just work on this series. Man plans, God laughs, as it were, because this whole thing happened with Planned Parenthood, and I needed to make something. And interestingly enough, the video that I was developing, or one of the videos I was developing for what libertarians actually believed, actually involved making a point about abortion subsidies or about Planned Parenthood subsidies that I wanted to use. But I thought it wasn't a strong enough point, and it wasn't as relevant to the issue. So I was like, all right, I can either throw this video up, which kind of has something to do with it, or I can be a masochist and stay up for 2 days straight around the clock just making this video because I need this message to get out there. So what I did is I went around and watched a bunch of videos in defense of Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. I picked out the arguments that pissed me off the most, and then I just wrote a script making fun of them. And basically, I didn't want to bite off more than I could chew, and I didn't want to turn people off because this is one of those things we need to reach out to people from all over for, especially considering the fact that it was being voted on. And so it's not a video about whether or not you should be pro-life or pro-choice. It's a video about whether or not Planned Parenthood deserves $540 million government dollars every single year. Mm. And of course, ideologues like you and I would say, well, no one deserves that kind of money. But obviously, or they would say no one deserves that kind of government money. But I couldn't just leave it at that. I had to make something that appealed to everyone. So I just brought up a bunch of other points about Planned Parenthood, the fact that they profit $90 million a year on their own. I debunked the statistic that abortion is supposedly only 3% of their services, and how the fact that taxpayers are forced to fund a facility which profits so much from abortion and which provides so many abortions is very much a violation of most people's consciences. And that's just such a controversial thing. It's insane to me that you'd ever get away with sending funding like that or funding to an organization like that, especially if that's some. And so, yeah, basically the arguments revolved around the fact that Margaret Sanger, the founder, was a eugenicist. That's not even just a hit or a cheap attack. That's a fact. Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Planned Parenthood was founded for the purposes of racial cleansing. The fact that Planned Parenthood, to this day, disproportionately aborts black babies at a far higher rate than white ones. And people say, all right, well, that's just because of economic circumstance and logistics. Mm. But police apologists say the same exact thing about police brutality. We obviously have a very sick system that doesn't value a certain type of human life. And it just so happens that being white helps a lot. I'm not a social justice warrior by any means. Don't get me wrong. Mm. But there is some, I mean, when you're an organization whose founder said you wanted to eliminate black people, and you kill black people or you abort black babies at a disproportionately higher rate than white people, you can't get mad at people for making that connection. And yeah. Then, of course, so, but yeah, I should talk more about the technicals of the video. I'm sorry, because all the information I'm ranting about is available in the video. But
yeah,
it was just
no problem. It's good.
Well, the video, folks, you should go check the video out now. But yeah, again, I really wanted it to be something that appeals to all sorts of different people, because so many people were confused about the bill to defund Planned Parenthood. Mm. This was not a bill on whether or not abortion should be legal. Mm. This was a bill on whether or not Planned Parenthood should be funded. And I think another one of my favorite arguments that they make is they do so much for breast cancer research, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. They don't have one licensed mammogram at any of their clinics. What they do is they tell women who enter their clinic where else they can go to get a mammogram. So saying Planned Parenthood provides mammograms is like saying the Yellow Pages provides pizza. They don't. They give you the name of a restaurant you can call to get pizza from. They'll give you somebody else's information. That doesn't mean they provide it. And then I think the first argument I make in the video is from just a little pro-choice character who says, look, I'm pro-choice, but this is a company that profits $90 million a year on their own. I mm-hmm. don't think they need my tax money.
Right.
But again, I'm sorry, I'm going to rant. The video was just thrown together really quickly. I just typed this thing up. Again, I pulled apart all these arguments that really annoyed me, put them into a script, read the script in this old-timey news announcer voice, threw together some animated bits, drew some pictures for graphics, and because I threw it together so quickly and I knew a lot of the images would be static as a result of lack of time and budget, I thought it would be interesting to make it look like an old-fashioned video by putting that kind of grain over the visuals, and also by bouncing the image around constantly, because that engages the viewer, believe it or not, because there's more motion. And then it was also funny just to make fun of Planned Parenthood by portraying them as this completely out-of-date organization that's full of garbage and is just another government-funded program that will never admit it did anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And Another reason that I wanted to make it look sort of like an old-fashioned infomercial, aside from the fact that they're government-funded, and that's just kind of how I generally portray government-funded things, is with that cliches 50 infomercial style.
Yeah.
But also because all of the things Planned Parenthood claims to provide, again, much of which it doesn't, but all the things Planned Parenthood claims to provide are things which are supposedly available under Obamacare, which the left thinks is the greatest thing ever. So literally in every way, the organization is just obsolete. There's other groups that do the services they do without the $540 million from the government. So that's my little rant on that. But that's basically my explanation for the video.
Awesome, awesome. You know, talking about, you know, the inherent eugenics and racism in government, kind of reminds me of the Social Security Act and minimum wage laws that were enacted. The Social Security during, I think, the New Deal, and then the minimum wage in the early, like really early 20th century, and how they really affected the black people specifically, right? Because they tended to be the lesser skilled in the population, right? Like, right after they came out of chain slavery, and they were actually improving. Like, they were contributing, and they were, you know, in terms of income, they were improving at a pretty rapid rate. And then you have the minimum wage come in, and you see the just decline of their, the ability of to maintain themselves on their own. And you see, you know, unemployment go up, and then even worse, you know, I think it's Lyndon Johnson's Great Society when he implemented, you know, for the welfare state and all this, all these subsidies and food stamps and things like that. And again, completely destroyed the black family specifically. And then I think Walter Williams, black economist, he wrote a few books on this, saying how, you know, the welfare state has done more to destroy the black family and tear it apart than chain slavery has done.
He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. I'm actually reading a book by Dinesh D'Souza called The End of Racism, and it talks a little bit about that. But you're absolutely right. The government has had just a specific distaste for that population of people for whatever arbitrary reason, and they've always seen them as human cattle, which isn't surprising because they see everyone as human cattle.
Yeah.
That's why we have taxes.
Right.
But it's insane because even after the minimum wage laws, which again were created to stop black people from competing, the black population was still able to do relatively well. It wasn't until the war on poverty that we saw as a whole, unfortunately, their population kind of take a turn for the worst in terms of poverty. I mean, the war on poverty made them more poor, just like the war on drugs bought more drugs to lower class communities.
Increased, yeah, right.
But, yeah, and there's also something to be said for the fact that I think for all in the audience who are unaware, the minimum wage laws were, initially passed because, look, if I'm black, there's a lot of discrimination and prejudice against me if I'm black, especially if I'm black, you know, 100 years ago, whenever these laws were first put into effect. The only way I'm going to be able to be hired is if I work for a little bit less. And people are going to say, look, I don't like black people, but he's willing to work for less, so I'll hire him. But the problem is, what happened is they set the minimum wage at a price which people were not willing to pay for a colored laborer for, but could hire a white laborer. So let's say I'm a white laborer, and I'll charge you $9 an hour, but then you could go to an African-American laborer for like $6 an hour. Mm-hmm. You're going to be more likely to choose the African-American labor. Their group is helped by this. You know, they're more likely to be brought out of poverty as a result. The white guy, you might hire him if you feel like it. Yeah. If I take the minimum wage and say, it's only legal to pay people what you were already paying the white guy, and it's now illegal to pay this guy any more than you're paying him.
Exactly.
Guess what? They're not going to start paying the black people more. They're just going to fire the black people and hire white people.
Exactly.
It's every single thing the state does to help the minority community completely makes things worse for them. And also, one last thing to point out about an extremely racist government institution that people aren't willing to point out, marriage licensing. Marriage licenses didn't exist more than 100 years ago, and every single time there's this gay marriage debate, I say, look, the government shouldn't be involved in licensing marriages in the first place. The only reason they license marriages is so that they could prevent interracial marriages from occurring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's funny, so many people are, you know, they're like celebrating these, you know, gay marriage you know, decision by the Supreme Court. But it's like, you know, I don't support it because I don't think the government should be involved in determining who, you know, you should be with.
Is like, married, yeah.
Why do you have to ask for permission from your political masters who you want to spend the rest of your life? You know, it's like that's completely the definition of a subject or a serf or a right. slave. You know, it's like stop asking for permission from people and just live your lives. It's like the only, I tell people, the only law that you should obey is your own conscience, right? Your own moral compass. That's it. Forget about everything else. If you're not harming people, if you're not, you know, robbing them, assaulting them or doing anything like that, then you're fine. You're a non-violent person. That's about it. Everything else, that every law that pertains to things that are non-violent, is basically a victimless crime law.
Crime.
Right?
So, yeah. I've actually got a number to say about that. Some things I agree with, some things I disagree with, but certainly you're right. And what's really annoying is particularly the fact that a lot of these gay couples were able to get all the same benefits that a straight couple gets through, what did they call them, civil unions, I believe. But it was so important to them that their rulers gave them the word marriage. Like, the politicians are saying, I'm getting all the same benefits, but the politicians aren't saying I'm married, and I can't feel as though my existence is valid unless the people in power are telling me it. It's such a sham, and especially because the left just 30, 40 years ago was saying that a marriage license is just a piece of paper. And they're right. A government marriage license is just a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. The state can't do anything to affect marriage. So, yeah, you're right. It's completely annoying. But, no, I'd also say that even though, again, I completely agree that victimless crime mm-hmm. laws are absolutely insane,
mm-hmm.
I think that maybe there's more to follow to have a civil society than just on violence. For example, one could argue that it's not a non-violent act to not take care of your child or be negligent. I know that Rothbard made this argument.
Yeah, but I
believe that there's certain duties one has to their family in particular that need to be met in order for us to have a functioning civil society. Because, again, you know, if you don't meet those needs, then it's very likely that your child will grow up to become violent or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one of the things that Rothbard, maybe went off the deep end a little bit. But
yeah,
but
he was red pilling. He was red pilling hard.
But he
invented the red pill.
Right. Yeah. He was the original Morpheus, right?
That's right.
But
Morpheus, you know, Rothbard.
It doesn't really worry me though about that kind of stuff, because I really think that boycott, or I say economic ostracism of people that violate those kinds of social norms that are not necessarily outright crimes, yeah. But that people just don't like. Like, for example, if a shopkeeper opens up his business and says, I'm only going to serve black people, or I'm only going to serve white people, or I'm only going to serve Mexicans, everybody would say, well, that's racist, right? Whoever you're serving, that's racist, because you're completely forgetting about other portions of the population. But that doesn't mean that there should be a law forcing that shopkeeper to serve everyone else. Rather, I'm sure people would be pretty angry, right? And so would want to boycott that institution. Either that, or there would be other entrepreneurs that would say, you know what? If I open the same business and I offer to those other groups of people, I think I can make a more successful business than this guy who's just catering to one portion of the population,
yes.
Right? So there are other ways to deal with these kinds of people, and social ostracism is it. So, you're right. If somebody...
I agree with you.
Yeah. So if somebody has kids and they neglect their kids, you know, they starve them or whatever, I don't know, physically abuse or whatever, you know, I think that I completely think that will get out. Like, something like that is it's just not really possible for people to hide as well. You know, it's like reputation is king, right? Even now, reputation is king, right? And even more so in a stateless society, without laws, without regulations, you know, people would only want to interact with and trade and make contracts with people who are, you know, upstanding, virtuous people, right? Who would really want to make a contract with a thief or with somebody that abuses their kids, right? So
I completely agree with you. I guess what I was trying to say is that I do believe in moral norms and standards outside of the non-aggression principle. However, I believe that a state or lack of state system should be predicated upon following the non-aggression principle. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. You need, I mean, there's going to be some degree of social ostracism without the state. So obviously, you wouldn't want to deal with the guy who's abusing their child. And that's kind of how it used to be. Back in the day, when you had smaller communities where everyone knew everyone's business, again, that's a little bit uncomfortable sometimes, but hell, everyone knows your business on Facebook today anyway. So right. If you were in a community where everyone knew everyone's business and you were some dude who knocked the girl up and didn't take care of the kid once she had it, dude, no one's going to hire you unless you agree to take care of that family. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many social mechanisms that can be put in place outside of the state. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if you're somebody who completely neglects your parental duties, I think it's absolutely appropriate for there to be social ostracism, because mm-hmm. I think the foundation, not to sound too cheesy, but the foundation of any civil Western society, or I should say the foundation of civil Western society in general, is the family structure. And if you're not taking care of your kids and passing on your values, property, and raising peaceful and civil members of society, that's a problem for everybody else and not just you. So you can't blame people for ostracizing someone who they perceive to be a bad parent, mm-hmm. even though we kind of have to like that. We like having this don't judge me attitude. And I think that annoys me the most when I see it coming from parents, when I, you know, see or hear from people who are parents saying something like, yeah, all right, I don't always take care of my kid with this or that or the other, but like, don't judge me till you've walked a day in my shoes. No, I don't care to walk a day in your shoes. How about you put yourself in your child's shoes and say, how would I feel if my parent wasn't taking care of me?
Mm-hmm.
That's my little rant on that. I think that's probably one of the things that was like hammered into my head the most in childhood, and I'm actually very happy for it. Yeah. One of the things my dad always used to say is, if you don't take care of your child, you're a failure. You know, if you don't take care of your child, you're a failure as a person. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do, and if you're not doing that, you're asking for bad shit for everybody else in society.
Yeah, of course. Actually, that reminds me of something that you know, the military people say, you know, when you are attacked the military for what they're doing, you know, they say, well, you don't know what it's like going over there, you know, fighting for your freedom. You don't know what we went through. You have no, once you go, you know, you're in our shoes and you're out there in the, you know, shooting, you know, kicking down people's doors and handcuffing these, you know, evil terrorists, then you can talk to me. And it's kind of like, it's like, wait a minute. So if I can't accept that rape is wrong unless I've raped somebody, or I can't accept that theft is wrong until I've robbed, you know, stolen from somebody. Like, well, how can I, like, are you seriously saying I have to be a murderer to understand murder is wrong? I mean,
it reminds me that, well, I get what you're saying. And I think that, I've always followed, like, for example, Aquinas' Just War theory, where it's like, if you're fighting a defensive war, then that's a whole nother story. But you're right, we are in unjustified wars. And I think a lot of the guys that go over there are just so misled, and that's really the biggest part of these crimes. I think that's the biggest moral crime of all of this, is these aren't young guys who just would have grabbed a gun and gone over to the middle of the Middle East. You know, like, these are people who were told by a system that this is what they should do. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's no moral accountability for anyone, but I guess the point is, it's just so sad that something like this only happens if you have a state system like ours. This is never something human beings would just do on their own. And then outside of that, yeah, it's weird that, like, you can't criticize our foreign policy, or else you're criticizing the troops, you're criticizing their hardships, or you don't sympathize with their plight or whatever. You can criticize what the government plans to do with his soldier, but not hate the soldier himself. You know what I mean? He'll even tell you he's there to follow orders from somebody else. Well, okay, I think the people who are giving you orders are bad people. It's not, and I shouldn't even say bad people because I don't know them, but I think they're making some bad choices. And I guess when you said, yeah, you can't like say rape is wrong unless you've raped somebody, that actually triggered my memory. I remember there's an old, I want to say it was Rothbard, I could be wrong, but somebody asked him when he was talking about economics and how we could solve issues related to poverty through the free market. They said, have you ever been poor? And his response was, yes, I've actually been very, very poor, but that's irrelevant. Would you only allow a doctor to cure your cancer if he himself had had cancer? You know, right. I loved that. Exactly. I loved that. It's like, you don't need to have there's a certain emotional struggle you can relate to if you've been in that situation.
Right,
but
right,
we should be making our choices solely based on emotion. Logic plays a role here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point that you brought up. And I tell that to people all the time because they do get it confused when I talk about the idea of government, the idea of statism, that, you know, that is wrong, right? The initiation of force is wrong. So we're against that. We're against the idea of statism. We're not against individuals, you know, necessarily. Mm-hmm. So when I say I'm against public school or government school, I don't hate all the teachers, right? Because
yes.
The teachers themselves may have good intentions. The problem is, you know, they may want to truly help the kids. The problem is they're functioning in an inflexible, you know, oppressive system where they can't innovate and cater to the individual because they have to adhere to certain standards and curriculum and national tests and all that kind of stuff. So it's the idea of statism that we're attempting to abolish. It's a mentality, right? It's a mental virus. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to do. Expel the mental excrement of statism from people that believe that, you know, government is really, truly something. Like it's not just, you know, because when you think of government, it's really, they have this special area in their place that's exempt from logic, exempt from ethics and
moral law
and morality.
They're above people. Mm. That's the issue with statism. Yeah. You're someone who says government is above natural moral law. No.
Yeah, exactly.
No human being is above natural moral law.
Yeah.
Even if they have a nice shiny badge or a nice costume. I didn't mean to cut you off though.
No, that's all right. That's right. Yeah, you're right. And so, you know, once you strip that title of government or the shiny badge or the costume, they're just people with guns robbing other people. And most of the time they're robbing peaceful people, right? Peaceful, productive, members of society, industrious, the middle class, you know, that's what they're robbing. So, you know, what Rothbard said, it's not like blacks against whites or the rich against the poor or, gays against straights. It's the government robbing the people.
it's the state against you.
The state against you.
But
right.
I have to ask you something. You said that you want to cure the virus of statism. How are you going to do that without Obamacare? Come on. Checkmate. If you don't have universal health care, you can't cure the statism virus. Checkmate, libertarians. I think you're right.
Go ahead.
I think you're right about most of that. It's very sad that, again, people do think that there are certain groups that are exempt from any sort of moral law. And, yeah, the state is very bad at that. Like, you know, what's theirs is theirs, and what's yours, that's also theirs. It's so insane. It's so loony. It's so sad that a lot of people can't see it. But there's another thing. For example, like with public school teachers, there is, again, this law of unintended consequences that goes with any state organization or any organization in general, but particularly with a state organization because they don't really have to worry about the negative repercussions of their actions as much.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually something I was discussing with my dad the other day about teachers' pensions and how we don't pay attention to this as an issue. But again, I'm in Cook County, and my father is actually a principal. And so there was a few years ago in Chicago, there was a big teacher strike. And I actually just remember him just mentioning something about how, you know, the school doesn't pay the pensions and the state pays the pensions. And so that's why a lot of taxpayers are upset, even if they're not from the area in which the school is located. And there was a number of mental experiments I did with this, but I think the outcome is, for example, there's a teacher at my school, the high school that I went to, who was a gym teacher who made $110,000 a year.
Hmm.
So here's the thing. I live in an area where people pay a lot of taxes. You know, the school can afford to pay him that. Mm-hmm. The problem is his pension doesn't come from the school. His pension comes from the state. So this is somebody who's going to be pulling in a pension for $110,000 a year. That's going to be like 80, 90 grand a year. Mm-hmm. His pension is going to be 80 or 90 grand a year, and the taxpayers supporting him aren't even going to be making close to that in the future, especially when you consider the fact that they're going to have so much taken out of their paycheck. Like when you look at the face of Chicago, for example, it's increasingly Hispanic, and there's a lot of people who are working in lower class jobs. So you're talking to people who are struggling to make 40 grand a year, and they're forced to support some retired person making 90 grand a year? That's insane. If we're going to talk about who needs what, statists love talking about who deserves the money. No one deserves to make that much money. Well, when it's money that's directly being taken from the government, directly being taken from the taxpayers, I think that becomes a much more valid discussion. And they're absolutely fine closing their eyes and closing their mouths and not saying anything when lower class people are forced to support old, rich white people who had good careers that are sitting on their pensions, or state pensions, I should say.
Yeah, and I would say that you know, a lot of people go into those kind of jobs, like, you know, policemen and school teachers, because of that promise of the pension. Whereas yep. they, you know, stable. What needs to be realized is that there is no pension. It's only what they've stolen from the taxpayers and what they are able to...
No, what they will steal.
Yeah, right, what they will steal. Yeah. And so, you know, there is no big pension fund there waiting for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's all... Same thing with... what is... yeah, I mean, so many unfunded liabilities that we talk about. It's like... I mean, come on. You know, look at Greece. Look at all these collapsing countries that are primarily composed of, you know, like you said, retirees, you know, people that are no longer producing and no longer adding value to society. And they're just like, you know, maybe the poor, the handicapped, or the disabled. They're just siphoning away resources from the productive class. Uh-huh. And that's that burden is getting heavier and heavier. Mm-hmm. And so what's the incentive for people to want to stay in that country and stay supporting these, you know, these people who are not doing anything, right? There is no incentive, right? That's, you know, that's where you get the brain drain, people fleeing to more economically free countries.
No, you're absolutely right. We see that in the United States a lot with just particular states. A lot of people are leaving Illinois to go to Indiana because Indiana's taxes are so much lower. No. And one thing that actually really made me laugh is there was some NPR broadcast in, or I shouldn't say NPR, it was a local news station in Chicago, but of course they're more liberal, and it's just funny to listen to them and see how blinded they are by their own agenda. But there was something they said about how there was, like, they're like, oh, there was a, like, 3% decrease in abortions this last year, and they said this is likely due to the fact that we have, like, increased funding to certain organizations which provide contraception.
Yeah.
People have left Illinois in the last year because of that tax hike. So the reason there's less abortions is because there's not as many people in the state. There are less people in the state. So there's going to be less people getting abortions. They left because you raised the taxes.
Right, like, right.
There's less activity occurring in our state because people are leaving. It's not... You know, of course, they pointed to something like abortion, which is generally unwanted by the general population, as opposed to something like general production. Like, the only reason they pointed to that is because it tends to have a negative connotation. So they said, all right, we have a decrease in overall activity. Let's pick out an activity that people maybe don't like, and we'll only focus on the fact that that's happening less, and then we'll say it's happening less because of the good things we're doing. Right. We're not going to point out that just in general, there's less activity, including productive activity, because people are leaving.
Yeah, yeah. I subscribe to the George Carlin notion that when he says, I have two rules. Yeah, my first rule is I don't trust anything the government says.
Yeah.
The second rule, I forget the second rule, but that's the most important rule.
The first one's the most important one. I don't trust anything the government tells me.
Right. Nothing. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's right. It's monopoly. It's a monopoly on violence, and it can really, you know, fabricate any statistics, any, you know, data that it wants. And it really has no verification, no competition, no reason that it should, you know, should be based on reality whatsoever. In the contrary, you know, it's the way Jeff Berwick describes it, it's like a state is a self-licking ice cream cone. It creates its own demand. You know, it fabricates it through the fear propaganda.
Yeah.
It fabricates its own demand, right, through fear, and then people clamor for more state laws, more regulations, more taxes, things like that. So they get
it's a very special kind of business.
Yeah.
Very special business. Yeah, it's very sad.
So yeah, so I don't want to keep you too long, but so why don't you let people know where they can find you. You know, plug your stuff once again before we sign off.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, my name is Seamus Coughlin. I was really happy to be here and have this conversation with you. My Twitter is at Seamus_Coughlin, and my name is spelled SEAMUS COUGHLIN. like Seamus Coughlin, but it's Seamus Coughlin. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/cartanimation, and my website is freedomtunes.com. And most importantly, because I'm a money-grubbing libertarian who's only in this as a capitalist, my Patreon account is patreon.com/freedomtunes. And if you don't donate to my Patreon page, I'm going to start making videos about misogyny in video games. And I'm going to talk about how I'm a personal victim, because that seems to work for Patreon. So unless you want to see that happen, you better give me money to keep making cartoons.
You know what? You know, it's funny you talk about being a money-grubbing capitalist. At least you're consistent. I'll give you that, because you know, you know, anarcho-communists, they say how much they hate money, and then they, you know, they purchase. It's funny, they purchase these shirts from like the capitalists with the faces of Che, right? And they're like, you know, down with capitalism, and they're like, all right, how much do you want for that shirt?
Yeah,
it's just funny. It's like capitalism is what has produced the comforts and the privileges and the luxuries that we all enjoy today, you know, 21st century lifestyle, yet everybody seems comfortable, you know, attacking it for whatever they think, you know, is acceptable or is unacceptable. You know, whatever they can enjoy, that's what they're attacking it for. they're not going to attack the idea that they have a laptop, that they have shoes, that they have air conditioning, that they, you know, that they have a car, that they have a smartphone. You know, those are fine. Capitalism can continue to produce those things. So.
Yeah, it's completely fine for a capitalist to produce a computer, which I will buy from them in order to blog about why capitalism is evil. Yeah. But beyond that, I don't want to be sullied by your dirty system, sir.
Right. And you know, what's it called? Employment is slavery, right? Exploitation. So
employment is slavery. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's insane.
Just riddled with hypocrisy. So awesome conversation, Seamus. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. I'm glad we finally were able to get this done.
Me too.
So if anyone wants to donate to my show, I accept PayPal, Bitcoin, and I'm also developing my Patreon. Hopefully I'll get that started quite soon. You can also donate gold and silver if you like. If I don't trust the black hole that is the USPS, but if you want to try to send, I think you're a brave soul, so you can try. But thanks a lot, Seamus. Awesome conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Awesome conversation. Really enjoyed it. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network and theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.